Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Just a quick note for our listeners, Mike and I usually record these pretty far in advance, and then we release them in the order in which we recorded them. For this conversation, we actually just recorded it last week. We're butting in line, so to speak, because we thought this was a little more timely to release it. If you're confused as to why we suddenly changed direction or anything like that, it was really more just that the timing is more relevant. So hope you enjoy. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
How are you?
You know, I'm well.
That's good.
How are you? Now, by the way, since our listeners, we try to have a little fun here early in the morning. The famous Puritan preacher, Thomas Hooker. Yeah, I know, really bad, really bummer of a last name there. Thomas Hooker, I think he's the one who famously said, "God loveth adverbs." What do you mean by that?
I assume most people say I'm good when you say how are you?
I'm doing good. And to which, other than according to Martin Luther, banking and prostitution, you're doing those two things, you're doing bad. But otherwise, whatever you're doing, it's good. But the point is, God wants you to do it well. So Hooker said, God loves adverbs. And so when you ask someone, how are you doing? I sometimes have fun with them. They say, I'm doing good. I said, well, so am I. This is great. But how are you doing? How are you doing? Not what are you doing? So sorry, listeners. We haven't been drinking.
That's a good way. I'm going to steal that. Same here. But how are you?
But how are you?
Well, there's a lot going on today in this climate. For me, in terms of news and politics, to be honest, in a lot of ways, I feel I've checked out, and my tendency has just been to sort of throw in the towel. It's just a mess, and I think a lot of listeners could resonate with that. as you pointed out earlier, many have two directions. One is to throw in the towel. The other is to throw rocks at the other side and call everyone else morons. And I don't want to do that. So I've just kind of settled with this is a mess, and we don't really know what's going on. But when I hear a lot of people talk about this, and anytime I try to get involved, if I do, I think I realize, man, we have no idea. We are often, particularly, we are ignorant of history. We are ignorant of consequences of actions. And we like to hear ourselves talk. So can you, Mike, can you make sense of kind of what's going on today? I mean, a lot has changed in terms of how we understand politics. I think some people don't realize that. And in some ways, things have always been this way. In others, they're relatively new in how we view that lens. So hopefully you can give us a breath of fresh air here and help us make sense of what's going on today.
Wow, that's a high bar. Maybe we ought to be drinking here early in the morning. But, you know, part of this doesn't remind me, there really is nothing new under the sun. There have been times, we have to remember, just before the war between the states, you had one senator caning another one, almost beat him to death with a cane. So tempers have run pretty hot at various times. But I am I do think we are in the suburbs of being Sadducees and Pharisees these days. And you might remember those clever chaps came to Jesus one set and then another, and they had all these questions about marriage and divorce and so on and so forth. And Jesus said, "Will you err because you've forgotten the original design?" And he takes them back to Genesis. And he dismantles their crazy questions and their crazy assumptions. And so I think if we kind of go back to the beginning, that would help us. So my wife and I live here in Annapolis. It's funny, you go elsewhere in the country and they go, "Oh yeah, Indianapolis."
Close.
I said,
"But how are you?"
Yeah. And then they say, "Good." And I say, "I'll forget it." So it's the city of Ann. So Polis, Annapolis, and I guess now that I think about it, Indianapolis, but Polis, P-O-L-I-S, is the Greek word for city. How do you build a city is politics. Now, if you think about the Bible, it starts in a garden and it ends in a city. So all of us should be about building flourishing cities. So all of us should be involved in politics. Politics are inherently good. So the first thing that comes to mind is when I hear Christians, and a goodly number, it seems, a goodly percentage has said, "I don't get involved in politics. And politics shouldn't have any place here in the church," which is in itself is a political statement. So you do have politics in the church. And if you're trying to build a community in your church, you are doing politics. So it's not inherently bad. We're at that same problem again when you tack a suffix or a different ending on the word, then you see it go south. So, for example, we're made as social beings, but we're not really made for socialism. We are made for, and not every ism, by the way, is bad, but we are made to be communal, but not communism. And so what we are seeing today, Pat, is what's called politicization. Whew. These words.
It's a big word, Mike. It's a big word.
Now, I'm training my grandkids. We have fun. How many syllables? So they go, politicization. So any idea what that means? Politicization.
Turning everything or more than we should into politics.
Yeah, very good. So everything created is good. Everything created. Now, it's susceptible to corruption, but it's inherently good. Politics is inherently good. We are to love all things in the order in which God loves them. Stealing that from Augustine. To love something too much, out of order, that is too much, too highly, is to make it an idol. To love it too little is ignorance. So there, listeners, is my seminary education kicking in. Start everything with the same letter. So it's either idolatry or ignorance. Those are the two great challenges that any of us face, any of us. And the ordering of our loves is a continual, lifelong challenge. Jesus kicked the game off for us, gave us the first two loves in order. They are, Pat?
Love God, love neighbor.
There you go. What's number three? See, it just depends on your station in life, so on and so forth. Yeah, Pat, you and I would say, love our wives, and so on and so forth. But say my wife passes. See, my loves, those three through 6,894,000, all those loves move around. So politics, we're to love it to the degree that God loves it. And so we are facing two big problems is you have some who idolize it, and that's politicization, and you're exactly right, He's making it the end all for everything, to solve all our problems. And then ignorance is privatization. Privatization are Christians I know who say, I just don't get involved in politics. Which is, we should grieve that. That's a lament. And so here we are in 2020. And you have an impeachment that for some, it's almost like the civilization hangs in the balance. And then you can go in other parts of the country and they're going, and say what? Because maybe they're a family that is community has been wrecked by opioid crisis, or they're struggling to make ends meet, or just got laid off. And they look at Capitol Hill and say, well, you can imagine what they say, but they just look and go, that's what a charade, what a charade. So we live in an age of politicization.
With politicization, I mean, I think if you are involved in politics to any extent, there is a strong tendency to just hate the other side, mm-hmm. particularly, I should say even amongst Christians and believers and religious individuals in general. Why is that? Why do we go to that extreme?
Yeah, it reminds me of the old Vince Lombardi. He's on the sideline during a game. Remember they mic'd him. He's one of the first they mic'd way back in the 60s. And he's watching some game. He's going, what the hell is going on out here? The famous Vince Lombardi quote. But I'm sure. So there's a couple of overlapping reasons that would be fun for us to explore a bit. Bernard Lewis, Princeton, he wrote a great article years ago. I think it was in The Atlantic. But it's called, I'm Right, You're Wrong, Go to Hell.
Very relevant.
Very relevant. Now, he was talking at that time about religious polarization. But we have political polarization in the same way. And it's fascinating that there's probably a lot of tributaries to this big, mighty Mississippi of political polarization. This is a big river rolling down the country. One of them is that it's fascinating that the left brain, the left hemisphere, biases either-or thinking. It tends to be single issue. And, of course, if you've read Ian McGilchrist, he has a wonderful little book you can get online. I think it's called Two Ways of Attending. We'll make sure listeners that get a link or a resource to that. It takes you 30 minutes to read the book. But the left brain, when it operates independent of the right, tends to reduce complex issues to very, very simple things. And you can see that in a soundbite culture, that people who are politicized, and I would say most of our political leaders, unfortunately, are politicized, frankly. That's the evidence, and that is the polarization, the lack of anything bipartisan, except if anyone was paying attention, one of the largest spending bills ever, there was ramrodded through before the end of the year. We are now on a pace, the biggest deficits ever. We are now on a pace for the biggest deficits ever in the history of our country. And the only thing that Washington has been able to agree on to date in this administration is spending more money. Now, I pause only because I'm a boomer. I'm part of this problem. And we are no longer kicking a can down the road. We're kicking a barrel of debt down the road. The reckoning is going to come someday. And listeners, I would recommend, if you have any interest in this, to read John Kay's book, Other People's Money, The Real Business of Finance. John Kay is at London School of Economics, but he has a theme throughout the book, and it's this: I'll be gone, you'll be gone. Not my problem. So we just racked up, took on enormous additional debt as a country. And we did it blindly. And so in a politicized culture, those who are politicized shrug, and those who are privatized don't pay any attention. They're not even noticing this. But the amount of debt that we are servicing now is staggering, and the bills are going to come due. You just can't postpone this forever. But you can postpone it until you're gone. As I was once sharing with a friend, I was talking about rising sea levels, and he lives near the coast, and he said, well, I'll be gone. Not my problem. And I just find that to be incredibly irresponsible as to what future generations are going to face. So this comes out of a politicized, polarized leadership that the only thing they can pass are spending bills. Now, all this raises the question, how do we get to where we are right now, Pat? Oh, yeah. Left brain. So the left hemisphere.
Welcome
the
back.
Left hemisphere tends to be single issue. And I think that explains to some degree where we are, because we are in a society and have been for several hundred years that heavily biases the left hemisphere. Chief of which is that the average person listening to this podcast would have no idea what we're talking about. They go, what do you mean bias the left hemisphere? I don't know. That's right. People who bias the left hemisphere tend to not even be self-aware of which hemisphere they bias. It is one of the compounding problems of just being in the left hemisphere. But it also tends to be single issue. So you have some who are politicized who say, it doesn't matter who gets elected. We just got to get rid of this president. There are others who are saying, the problem is fat cat millionaires and billionaires. That would solve our problems. There are others who say, we've just got to get conservative judges on the Supreme Court. We forget the wisdom of a few believers on Capitol Hill who understand that politics is downstream. What does that mean?
Well, that's actually one of the more eye-opening things I think you've told me in the past. Politics is downstream, meaning that by the time, for the most part, there are exceptions, but by the time things become political issues, culture has already like kind of made a decision on it.
That's right. It's the nature of politics versus the nature of, let's say, where you work, Pat. So you work for a sportswear and so on and so forth, but business operates on desire, which is, that is the way God made us to operate, desire. And so business has to be compelling. So compelling is, you might offer, you might be running a coffee shop, but you can't make people drink your coffee. You've got to compete. And in that regard, competition is not necessarily bad. Government, by nature, was coercive, rightfully so, to tamp down evil and to promote justice. But it does that by being coercive. And here's what we mean by coercive. It's the old Steve Martin skit. Doesn't pay his taxes. IRS shows up at his front door. Knock, knock, opens the door. Didn't pay your taxes. I forgot. They don't buy that. He goes, I'm so sorry. That's not going to work either. You don't have the option of not paying your taxes. Now, someone would say, oh, yeah, my Uncle Louie never paid his taxes. Yeah, and Uncle Louie, if he got caught, he pays a penalty. If he refuses to pay the penalty, he enters the penal system or the justice system and then the Department of Corrections. It's coercive. Government is by nature necessarily coercive. It actually creates the institutions to create boundaries. And so go ahead and run that red light. You may feel you have the right to do that. But if there's now cameras there, you will get a ticket, and just try not paying the ticket. But I can walk by an Under Armour store and I'm not coerced to buy anything. So that's why politics is downstream, because it can only support what is a consensus in the community at large. So right now, probably if they just ram through an abortion bill, even though I'm opposed to abortion, it would probably, it could be the next civil war. And so part of the reason I named my institute after Clapham, C-L-A-P-H-A-M, Clapham, that was that group of activists in Clapham, England, who rightfully understood politics and its role, and worked over the course of over four decades to abolish the English slave trade. But they did that by economic reform, business reform, all sorts of things. They had to re-triangulate the economy, which ran on sugar through slave labor. But along the way, they also made incremental changes in the law, so that by 1833, a bill passed that abolished the entire trade. They understood that politics was downstream. Americans, we see less of that case. There were abolitionists. They were very, very good abolitionists. But we never really built a movement where people imagined that it was a heinous evil, as happened in England. So we ended up trying to solve that at the end of the day by a war, which still to this day still stains some of our country, because that's a lousy way to try to resolve a political issue. So the left hemisphere tends to be single issue. It also tends not to understand paradox and complexity, it's called. And paradox is where two seemingly opposing things can actually both be true. Jesus, fully God, fully man. It's not, well, which one? Both. And there is probably some, there is merit in some of what socialism is trying to promote for social good, and there is merit in what capitalism is trying to propose for the use of your wits and initiative and economic initiative for promoting economic prosperity. There's some truth in both of them, but you really have to be more of an ambidextrous thinker or not politicized to understand how would you actually take the best of those and produce a system that understands human nature, desire, things like that. But all that is the political aspect is simply way down the line in terms of, so what kind of a tax structure would promote economic initiative? And that's where you have your two big debates right now, because the conservative wing tends to want to promote or stimulate economic initiative, and the what's called you call it right or left, and the left tends to promote more what's called redistribution. And redistribution, I understand, it comes from the idea that capitalists are never going to be virtuous, and so we have to coerce the money out of their pockets to redistribute it to create a more fair and just society.
Your statement about coercion is really fascinating. I actually hadn't thought about it that way, but it is interesting to see that there seems to be almost this last effort land grab, particularly with our understanding as Christians, like you said, this, if only we just had this, if only we had conservative judges, that type of thing. And that's definitely more in the conservative Christian camp. But it is, it's that sense of if we can just force people to do this, which in by itself like you said, is an oversimplification. How do we operate? So my default has kind of been, well, there was what I would probably describe as an awakening for myself of how ignorant and arrogant I have been in terms of politics and the answer, and slowly realizing that I fell right into that camp of we just need this or we just need that. Mm-hmm. And as I sort of awoke to the reality that I'm not as smart as I thought I was, I kind of resolved to just understanding, hey, I actually, well, one of the best things that happened to me was I grew up in more of a conservative household, and one of my best friends in college was a strong believer who was super left. And just to get to know him better, and as funny as we went on together, he slid over to the right and I slid over to the left. But it just started to awaken me to this understanding that, man, it's shocking. Both sides genuinely want to do good. Like, I think that statement alone would erupt in anger. So I may have just hung myself. I don't know. But I've met people on both sides, that people that look to the right and go, wow, you don't care about the sick and the homeless and the poor. And people that are on the left that, wow, all you want to do is take money away and have power to do whatever you want with it. You know? And so it's just like, there's good intention on both sides, but my answer has been just to step away and say, well, I know there are good people on both sides, and I know this is more complicated and complex than people resolve. And so I'll just kind of sit back and remove myself. How do we avoid that? Or how do I get out of that trap?
Yeah, well, there you go. You said it. Two things you said. First, step away. So that means you're, as a believer, you're going back to a privatized faith.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But you can step back without stepping away.
Mm.
So you said it earlier, the problem, and well said, you have people on the right, people on the left. So where's the solution? The middle. Now, that's not some kind of abstract, airy-minded, vague, egghead, blah, blah, blah. Let me see if you can unpack this just a little bit, Pat, because I think that the best way forward was articulated by a man named Lord Moulton way back in 1912. And Moulton was a judge, and he gave a talk. I believe the talk he gave was it was at the Authors Club in London, and it came without notes, but you can find it in The Atlantic. It's called Law and Manners, and it was published in The Atlantic. So for listeners, I want you to imagine an oval on its side, or a circle, either way you want to do it, but imagine a circle, and on the far right, write these words, absolute freedom. And then on the far left, write positive law. Now here's Moulton's point. He says, a society, the degree to which it flourishes is how much what I call this moral middle pushes out. And he called this the domain of obedience to the unenforceable. Brilliant phrase. Let's unpack that a little bit. So in the middle, the domain of obedience to the unenforceable. So if you have this picture in your mind here, you have this circle, far right, freedom, far left, law, middle, domain of obedience to the unenforceable. So here was Moulton's point. Societies collapse when one of these two domains on the right or the left encroaches and collapses the middle. So let's start on the right, which tends to be more the Republican and tends to be libertarians, capitalists, free markets, And what you find with politicized is they want to see color the whole circle with freedom. A freedom in and of itself is a good thing. But the founders talked about freedom to be what we ought to be, not what we can be. So if freedom is just what you can do, you can do a lot. But it may not be for the benefit of all. And that's part of what Silicon Valley is running into now. We can crush this thing, man. We can make a ton of money. We can rule the world. And we can also invade your privacy, and we can know things about you have no idea. We can track things you have no idea we're tracking. Is that the freedom? Is that the freedom they ought to have? I think there's some questions about that. On the far left is called law, and law is this. I doubt many of our readers will read through this, but Robert Caro, Caro, wrote a four-volume history on the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Caro is a fascinating writer. He also writes big, 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 big books. And so I don't know a whole lot of people that get slogged through them. But Lyndon Baines Johnson grew up in Southwest Texas in the late 1800s. And Carroll says his life was essentially like someone living in the Middle Ages. He takes some 30, 40 pages to talk about the typical workday of a woman, a mother, a wife, who would have to go on average 8 miles or so, I think it was, or I don't know what the mileage was, to go fetch water and carry it back in two jugs on her shoulders, 30 pounds each. His point was by their mid-30s, the average woman living in Southwest Texas was worn out, haggard. And Johnson grew up with in poverty. And when the railroad decided to come to a town some 30 miles away from where they lived, that was the end of his town. And he began to realize, you know what? If you control the levers of law, like who decided these codes? Who decided where eminent domain came in? Who decided where this land went? He became what became known as the Progressive Movement. The Progressive Movement said, you have these rich robber barons who are making vast amounts of money, but the have-nots are really becoming more have-not. And they don't seem to give a damn, these robber barons. So while Vanderbilt's building an enormous 50-plus room mansion, Johnson's watching his mother become an old hag because of you iron one day by having two blazing fires in a house where it's 110 degrees outside. And the wind's blowing, and you're trying to iron sheets, and they go on hang them in between the sand that's in the air and the wind. They come back, they're hard as boards. And you do that all day. And then you cook all afternoon. So he made it a point that he was going to gain the levers of power through law. So back to the Oval. Those on the right tend to want to, they overplay their hand. In other words, there's such a thing as too much of a good thing. When you overplay the hand of freedom, you encroach on the moral middle and a society begins to collapse. We ought to be free to do what we ought to do, and hence capitalists that I know have not read Adam Smith's first book. Yes, he wrote The Wealth of the Nations, but he also wrote in 1759 The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And if I were to try to create the dummies version, since I am a dummy, so I'm qualified, it's basically virtuous people. Only virtuous people can produce virtuous capitalism that seeks the well-being of all. And so freedom is not absolute, it is bounded by moral law. Over on the far left, you have those who want to simply legislate till the cows come home and coerce virtuous behavior. So if we can get all the fat cat millionaires and billionaires raise the tax, we'll have enough money to pay for Medicare or health care for all. Healthcare for all is a lovely idea. But as some candidates right now are finding out, it's the economics is where the thing really falls apart. And so Moulton said the greatness of a society is determined by how large this moral middle is, that is the domain of obedience to the unenforceable. Now, I know for some of us, as I roll through that, you're listening going, what exactly does this mean? Let me give you a quick example. Marriage, another institution ordained by God. The degree to which Kathy and I have a flourishing marriage is the degree to which we are obedient to what is unenforceable. What does that mean, Pat?
Well, there are a lot of things. There are a lot of things in marriage that you could do that aren't necessarily breaking laws.
Give me an example that would not be good for our marriage. Even though I'm absolutely free, if it's entirely about absolute freedom, I'm free to do what? Because sure. She did, by the way, vow sickness or in health, poverty or riches. She promised to stick with me no matter what.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, a very simple example in my mind is something I've seen before, but I can spend money however I want it.
That's right. I could have an affair.
Sure.
I could dream about all sorts of women. I'm free to do that. Because she said, I'm with you no matter what, Mike. I'm free. Does that make a great marriage?
Very doubtful.
No. And you're right. Money is another one. I know marriages that where they, I hear the couple say, you know, I have my money and she has her money. And I go, whatever happened to two become one? Those are all indicators of a lack of trust. And so absolute freedom. Now, I'm also bound up in institutions. So how healthy is my marriage if I say, well, we signed a piece of paper, so we're married. We're legally married. That sounds good. People would love to climb into that. That's where you don't have a very healthy marriage. If in fact, the reason you're only doing right is that you're bound by law. Like you say, well, a divorce would cost me a ton of money. Or we signed that paper. So you can see why in a marriage, flourishing marriages are where people are obedient to what is unenforceable. Kathy can't make me love her. I can't make her love me. So why is she obedient to what's unenforceable? Because she's a virtuous person. We seek to be virtuous people. Virtuous people push out the moral middle. So if you can imagine the circle in the center, the domain of what he called obedience to the unenforceable is when it expands. Now, it will never take up the entire circle because there will always be a proper place on the far, far left edge for law, politics. And there's also way, way over here on the right, always a place for absolute freedom in terms of, I say, I really like veggie pizza. I'd like to be free just to get a slice of veggie pizza. And you're right. Has no bearing on our marriage one way or another. And so that's what we mean by a proper place for freedom and law. And in our society, that moral middle, in my opinion, this what's called obedience to what is unenforceable is collapsing. And it's collapsing in both ways. So on the right, you have people fearing the overreach of progressivism into every area of your life, what's often called the nanny state. There was that famous website that was ginned up in the Obama administration. And Julia, a fictional character, would be taken care of cradle to grave. On the other side of the coin, though, you have those on the right who are basically arguing for free markets, which I don't think, Adam Smith, if you take his two books, was arguing for morally bound markets, not free markets, because Americans don't understand freedom. Most Americans, I should say, don't understand freedom or liberty to do what you ought to do. They understand liberty as I want to do what I want to do. And neither one of those expands this moral middle. So that's one way to think about it that you might give some thought to. You could read Moulton's very brief talk and just Google it. You'll find it in The Atlantic. The other thing I'd encourage people to read, and I think the Trinity Forum has a small little booklet on it, but it's this golden triangle. It's the what the founders put together for this great experiment called America. And Charles Murray, in his book, Coming Apart, does an excellent recap in the middle of the book on this golden triangle. So now that we've got the circle in your head, set that over here on the shelf and then gin up in your imagination a triangle. And here's the triangle. You can read about it in these booklets or you can read about it in Murray's book. The triangle at each point, one point is liberty, and then in the other point of the triangle, put religion, and the other one put virtue. Okay, so you have liberty, religion, virtue. Now, in that order, let's walk around the triangle. Start at the top, liberty. Liberty, a free society, liberty, rather, is the only thing that can promote what is understood properly as the proper place of religion. It's uncoerced. And so liberty is what drives proper religion. So I'm always I kind of lament when I hear pastors pick on religion. You know, we're not into religion. To which I want to say, well, you know, you're going to meet James one day, and he wrote about religion being good and true, and he's going to be a little miffed with you. And of course, you'll be in heaven, so you won't turn into a fist fight, but let's not make a... It's another example of religion is inherently good. Religiosity is not. Get straight on this, because we've created a generation of Christians going, we're not into religion. We're into a relationship with God. That's that single issue left brain problem. We are actually into both. James, this is true religion, caring for widows and orphans. All right, enough of that little soapbox.
That's a good point, though. That's a good point.
So virtue... I mean, liberty is what actually promotes great religion, positive religion, because it's uncoerced. But religion is the only thing that can produce virtuous people. So now we're in the third leg. And only virtuous people can sustain liberty. We're back to the top. So if you can imagine now, overlap a circle around this triangle and have the circle go round and round and round and round. This is what the founders, the framers rather, said is the great experiment. The great experiment is liberty is what sustains free and uncoerced religion. And only that kind of religion produces virtuous people. And only virtuous people can sustain liberty. And only this kind of liberty can sustain religion. And only this kind of religion can sustain virtuous people. I think you get the point. Washington, in his farewell address, said this is an experiment because no civilization that he was aware of was able to sustain liberty. And here's what we mean by this. In fact, Lincoln, we'll get to his Gettysburg address because he resurrects this idea. Liberty requires three things. You have to win it. They did that with the revolution. You have to order it. That's the great experiment. And then you have to sustain it. Win it, order it, sustain it. The framers, with the Constitution and also with this golden triangle, you can call it, that's the order. That's how you sustain it. Liberty is sustained by religion that is free and uncoerced, and that religion sustains virtuous, creates and yields virtuous people, who sustain liberty. Side note, Charles Murray, in his book Coming Apart, says that of the three legs, religion is now out of the picture. It's now out of the picture because it's primarily a privatized experience. We have brought this on ourselves. He believes neuroscience is replacing it, that it better understands human nature and could produce virtuous people. You may not agree, but just understand that's what it means to be in a post-Christian world where we can do whatever we want and play with our faith on the weekend. But the framers and the Constitution does not talk about freedom of religion. It talks about free exercise of religion. That is, religion is to be exercised in the public sphere for producing virtuous people who can sustain liberty. We hardly do that anymore. We create, by and large, left and right politicized people. That's not virtuous. That can't sustain liberty. And so we are shrinking away from the public sphere. Neuroscience is replacing it. All right, back to our story. So in this experiment, Washington's question is, if you can sustain it. Franklin said the same thing. When someone supposedly asked him on the street coming away from the Constitutional Convention, you know, what do we have? And he said, a democracy, if you can keep it. So that's the experiment. Less than 100 years later, on the after the great conflagration, the great battle at Gettysburg, Abraham Lincoln is asked to make a few remarks, almost an afterthought after Everett, the president, former president of Harvard, was asked to speak. He spoke for 2 hours, by the way. And Lincoln has a few thoughts. And his thoughts center around the rebirth of this original experiment, the brilliant talk, the Gettysburg Address, this nation conceived. So he didn't give the talk that his advisors did, which was basically we whooped him at Gettysburg, let's roll to the finish and finish this war off. No. He never called the Confederacy a nation. They were brothers. They were friends. This was a family spat. A family's going to come back together. We're going to get back to the experiment. In another talk, Lincoln, though, warned of three great enemies of sustaining this political experiment, and it is political in a good way. One is exterior, one is interior, that is external forces. Some country could come in and conquer us. He didn't really feel that was a problem, primarily because of geography. Hard to get a European power over to America. Internal, that is internal revolution and collapse. He didn't even fear that as much either. Guess what the third one was?
I don't know.
This is where Lincoln was brilliant with his metaphors, and we'll close probably at this point. He said he called it the silent artillery of time. What did he mean by that?
That we will forget.
That's right. Lincoln said the greatest problem with sustaining this experiment of religion, virtue, and liberty, proper politics, is the silent artillery of time. That in 2020, you'd be driving along in your car, listening to a podcast from some knucklehead in Annapolis, and he quotes Lincoln and the experiment, and you go, I've never heard of this. And he's talking about my country. I have never heard this before. The silent artillery of time. So, Pat, politics is inherently good. Politicization, is idolizing it, making too much of it. Privatization is making too little of it, poo-pooing it. I'm not involved in politics. Politicization drives people to the right or left. Freedom or redistribution law. Those two, and idolizing them, idol wants to run everything, and so you want to make the entire society redistributionist law, and the moral middle disappears. Or you want it to be entirely free market, and the moral middle disappears. I'm concerned about our great experiment, because this triangle cannot survive without religion. I do think neuroscience is providing a lot of great insight into human nature. And I think that we actually gave up this part of the triangle by going into an enlightenment view of human nature. And perhaps in another podcast, we'll go into more detail in terms of neuroscience. Even down to, if you think about it, why did God create a brain with two hemispheres? Wouldn't it have been more efficient just to have one? And I'll share with you, this actually is one more pointer to the gospel in human nature. And so I think that religion can get back in the game by understanding better the language and literature of neuroscience, just as the sons of Judah in the Babylonian Empire got the faith back in the game by, over the course of 3 years, studying the language and literature of the Babylonians. So they saw a seamlessness between what Nebuchadnezzar was saying and what the Jewish scriptures said.